Welcome to Illinois Family Spotlight, a conversation about issues of the day from a biblical perspective, as well as highlights from interviews, conferences, and events. Here's Monty Larrick.
Thanks for making Illinois Family Spotlight part of your day. We're featuring Riley Gaines' remarks during the Illinois Family Institute's 2025 Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet in Homer Glen. Riley is a 12-time All-American collegiate swimmer with 5 SEC titles. Her success in the pool is matched by her success in championing the protection of women's sports and private spaces, as well as the rights of the unborn. And she advances other conservative causes through the media and Turning Point USA events.
Well, thank you guys, though I hope you feel just a little bit embarrassed for giving someone a standing ovation for merely saying men and women are different. I don't know. It's kind of like my whole shtick. The debate I challenged AOC to recently, just let me provide a little bit of context there. I posted a picture. This was leading up to the mayoral race in New York City, right, of course, where Mamdani, the self-described Muslim socialist, of course, he won this race. I posted on social media a photo of AOC, Mamdani, and Bernie Sanders after one of the rallies, and I said something to the effect of, like, socialism is bad, right? AOC went on to quote tweet this on X, and she said something like, maybe if you channeled all of this anger into your swimming, you would have swam faster, right? So I thought about how I wanted to respond to this. Typically, when your positions, the stances that you take on the issues that your party is advocating for, when they're as indefensible as the Democratic Party's platform, all you can really do is call someone else names or in mudsling. And so I thought to myself, I had a couple things typed out, and I was going down that route initially, which I'm not proud to admit as a Christian, something to the effect of calling her a bartender, right? There were some things I had written out. But I ultimately deleted what I had initially written. I was set to go on Fox News that evening, and rather than resorting to name-calling, I figured I would do exactly what Charlie Kirk would do in this moment, which is to challenge ideas, to speak the truth and challenge ideas. And so I challenged her to a debate, which of course I knew she would never accept this. But I said, look, you can defend socialism, I'll defend capitalism, you can defend child sacrifice, I'll defend the sanctity of life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To which she then goes on, she takes the clip from Fox News. She says, you can challenge me to a debate, but I challenge you to get a real job. Thought about what I wanted to say here, which it's totally nonsensical to say I don't have a job. I'm an employee with Turning Point USA, a national best-selling author. I host a show on Fox, on Outkick, a podcast there. So that was just nonsensical entirely. But in thinking about it, of course, the most purposeful and satisfactory and rewarding and fulfilling job that I have is being a mom. And so that's what I responded back to AOC. This is the best job I could have. I notice you don't have kids. You don't have a daughter of your own like I do. And maybe if you did, although unlikely considering how self-absorbed and narcissistic you really are, it's unlikely you would feel differently, but maybe if you had a daughter of your own, you wouldn't want a man in her locker room. A little bit of context for that AOC. But look, I'm so excited and grateful to be here. My days the past month have just been all over the place. I don't know what day it is. I was looking down at the calendar today and I saw that it was November 7th. And I thought back to where I was 367-ish days ago to the day, and how grateful I am that November 5th of 2024 went in the direction that it did. And again, to think about how things could have gone just about a year ago to the day, right? I mean, we all felt it. We all saw it. The weakness abroad, the chaos at the border, lawlessness in the streets. We felt our values of faith, of family, of freedom, of fairness, slipping further and further away. Praise God that Donald Trump is back in the Oval Office serving as the 47th president. And look at the success, the wins that we have seen in just one short year. The return of strong leadership. We have seen peace deals in the Middle East. We have seen the reversal of weak policies that put everyone else first but the American people. We've seen some fantastic executive orders that protect women's rights, that protect parental rights, that protect the safeguarding of children, preventing men from competing in women's sports within any educational program that receives federal funds. We've seen the defunding of Planned Parenthood, at least for 1 year, in the Big Beautiful Bill. Let's be very, very clear. Planned Parenthood is a sinister organization. It received $792 million in our money, in taxpayer funds, every single year. And with that money, they perform nearly 400,000 abortions annually. They administer and inject minors and adults with synthetic, unnatural chemicals and substances. They promote gender ideology. They support the Democratic Party politically. What Planned Parenthood sells, it's not compassion. No, it is fear. It is convenience that is dressed up as freedom. This is a billion-dollar industry that profits off of panic. It profits off of fear and insecurity and vulnerability. Again, it is not empowerment. One more personal win that I can speak to, that my family has been able to benefit from since President Trump was sworn in back in January. My husband is here tonight. He's the 6'4" British guy who has, like, now living in Nashville, like this country British accent, and he's like rocking a real mullet now. It's totally different than what he looked like coming over to the United States in 2018. But he came over here from England to swim. He was an athlete at the University of Kentucky as well. That's where we met. We started dating. We got married in my senior year of college, so in 2022. So I guess we've been married for over 3.5 years now. Of course, yeah, absolutely. Of course, when you marry an alien, which is what I call him all the time, of course you have to go through the immigration process, right? This wasn't a surprise to me nor him. We had an immigration lawyer. He told us, look, you'll apply for your green card. You'll wait 6 months, 8 months max, and you'll be good. So we do that. We wait 6 months. We wait a year. We wait a year and a half. We wait 2 years, 2.5 years. We had heard nothing from USCIS or immigration services under the previous administration when Joe Biden was president. So we began to inquire, reaching out to every agency, every department, you know, what's the holdup? Bear in mind, he was still here legally the entire time. There will be people on social media who hear this story and have literally accused me of harboring an illegal alien. It would be easier for them if they said they just knew nothing and understood nothing about our legal immigration process. That would be more efficient and a better use of their time. Of course, he was here legally the entire time. But nonetheless, we couldn't get any answers until finally we get a letter to our house. This was in January of 2025, earlier this year, right before President Trump was inaugurated. And this letter said, in big bold letters, it said, request for evidence. And so we open it up. And it says, sorry, we can't actually give you your green card because your medical record is incomplete. What was missing from my husband's medical record in the year 2025? The ineffective, under-researched COVID vaccine. That's why they weren't willing to give him his green card. I'm sure they made every single person who crossed the southern border illegally have their COVID vaccine. I'm sure of it. Anyways, praise God, Donald Trump won. Praise God, he was inaugurated in January. Yeah. I give it 24 hours before I pick up the phone. Hey, did you know this mandate, this illegal mandate, what I would deem illegal, is still in place nationwide? He said, no, give me 2 hours. And literally within 2 hours, it was not a text, it was not a call, it was, I saw a headline on Fox News, a Fox News alert. It said, President Trump vacates nationwide mandate requiring legal immigrants to get the COVID vaccine. So a few months ago, we got this little green card in the mail. Don't know why I didn't think it was a green card. Spoiler alert, it's literally a green card. I could speak to the wins and the success that we have seen for hours, for certainly the rest of my allotted time. But I guess all that to say, I'm not tired of the wins yet. And we've got 3 more years of it. So good news. I'm just going to give you a very brief overview of, I guess, how I have found myself here. As I alluded to, I was an athlete at the University of Kentucky. I'll flash forward here to my senior year of college. actually ended up concluding my junior season by placing 7th in the nation, which I was proud of, right? To be top 8 in the country, you're an All-American, it's a pretty high honor, but didn't go my best time. I knew I was capable of more, and so it was really right then and there, placing 7th in the country my junior year, that I set a goal for my senior year to win a national title, which would of course mean becoming the fastest woman in the country in my respective event. And so senior year rolls around, I'm right on pace to achieve this goal about midway through my senior season. I was ranked 3rd in the nation in the 200 freestyle, trailing the girl in 2nd, a girl I knew very well, by a few 100ths of a second, very small margin. Our sport is one that's measured in very small margins, again, 100ths of a second. But the swimmer who is leading the nation by body lengths, might I add, was a swimmer that I'd never heard of before. None of us actually had ever heard of this swimmer. This was the first time we became aware of a swimmer named Leah Thomas. Lots of red flags at the time. Keep in mind, I had not seen a photo of this person, or else I think things would have been a little more clear. But for all I knew at the time, this was a senior from University of Pennsylvania, which is not a school that has ever historically produced that caliber of swimmer. Again, leading the nation by body lengths in events ranging from the 100 freestyle, which is a sprint, all the freestyle events in between through the mile, which is, of course, long distance. I mean, none of it made sense. I'm talking to my coach, who is this? We had no idea. And we continued to stay in the dark until an article came out disclosing very briefly, at a blip of a sentence, it said word for word, Leah Thomas is formerly Will Thomas and swam 3 years on the men's team at University of Pennsylvania before deciding to switch to the women's team for his senior year. When I read this, I was shocked, naturally, right? Like my whole team was shocked, but really I felt relieved when I read this, like, oh, this person's not a threat to me or to the national title that I hope to win because he's a man, right? Surely there are rules in place that would prevent him from competing with the women when it came to, you know, hoping to achieve a national title. I mean, this is a pinnacle of our sport. Comparatively, that the NCAA championships is faster than the Olympics because of how much depth the U.S. has, how people from all over the world come to the U.S. to participate in NCAA athletics. Surely there were rules in place, right? We prevent doping, so I would imagine they would prevent male levels of testosterone in women's sports. That feeling of relief was only further solidified when I went to look up who Will Thomas was. I was curious if this was a lateral movement, as if that would make it any better, but I was curious, is this someone who went from ranking amongst the best of the men to now continuing to rank amongst the best of the women, which is of course not what we saw. We saw that this was really a less than mediocre male swimmer competing at the Division I level in his rightful category, the men's category, ranking in the 400s and 500s nationally the year prior to, again, just 12 months later, dominating the entire country of women. But again, that's why I say I felt relieved. Thought the NCAA would see it how I saw it, and how my teammates saw it, and how my coaches saw it, and how my family saw it, and how anyone with any amount of brain activity would probably comprehend this. Again, nothing hateful about it, nothing even opinionated about it, looking at the sheer facts on the paper in front of us. But lo and behold, the NCAA saw nothing wrong with this. And so a few weeks before our national championships, they released a statement saying that his participation in the women's category was a non-negotiable, meaning there was nothing we could do. There were no questions that we could ask. There were no concerns that we could raise as women, as female athletes. We were quite literally told we had to accept this with a smile on our face. And so I watched that first day. It was the 500 freestyle, which is not an event that I typically do. And so I watched on the side of the pool as he swam to a national title. Again, beating out Olympians, beating out American record holders. They're not scrubs. They're the most impressive and accomplished, the fastest swimmers, female swimmers, this world has ever seen. And he beat them all by body lengths. He became the first man to win a Division I NCAA women's title. Trailblazer. Second day of competition was the 200 free, which is the event that he and I raced in. And so get on the blocks. That's the championship final. It's the top 8 women in the entire country. And I look over at the lane next to me, and there what was very visibly a man was on that block. 6'4", his size 15 feet, taking up the entire diving block. It's literally like a South Park episode, but real life. Or like a Babylon Bee headline, or like an SNL skit when SNL was actually kind of funny. But no, this, it was like that South Park episode, it turned into like a documentary. So we dive off the blocks and we swim 8 laps of freestyle, and I touch the wall at the end and I look up at the scoreboard behind me, and almost impossibly enough, we had gone the exact same time, down to the 100th of a second, meaning that we had tied, which is number one, incredibly embarrassing for a 6'4" man. He couldn't even beat me. But two, it's rare, right? You're racing for a minute and 40-ish seconds, and not even 1/100th of a second separated us, which you can't tell me that's not divine intervention. But anyways, we get out of the water and we go behind the awards podium, where the official looks at both him and myself, and he says, "Great job, you two, but you tied. We don't account for ties. We only have one trophy, so we're gonna give the trophy to him. Sorry, Riley, you just don't get one." I was so taken aback in this moment, right? Having just competed, my heart rate was high, my adrenaline was still pumping, and so the first thing that I thought ended up being the first thing that I said, and the first thought that I had was, isn't this everything that Title IX was created to prevent from happening? What do you mean you're going to give the trophy to the man in the women's 200 free? I asked the dreaded question no one dared ask all season, and I said, why? What's the thought process? What's the rationale or the justification here? To which, of course, they didn't have any. They weren't given a script of what to say when someone asked why. They didn't think anyone would, which is a sign of the times. But I appreciate his honesty. The official, he looked at me, and his face changed. He looked sad. He sounded sad. The official, I could tell he didn't even believe what he was about to say. And he says, "Riley, I am so sorry, but we have been advised as an organization that when photos are being taken, it's crucial that the trophy's in his hands. You can pose with this one, but you have to give yours back. He takes the trophy home. You go home empty-handed. End of story." That was the moment when I will never forget standing on that podium, right, sharing my placement with a man standing 8-9 inches taller than me, holding this trophy I knew I had to give back. And I just had this realization of, you know, Riley, how in the world can you expect someone to stand up for you if you're not even willing to stand up for you? That's what I was doing. I was waiting for someone else because I thought someone else would. I thought surely there would be a coach at some point over the course of that season who would say something. Surely there would be someone within the NCAA, someone with political power, some other swimmer, someone's dad, quite frankly, would come down there and yank this man out of our locker room like my dad so desperately wanted to do. But it was then and there I decided that it had to come from us as women, as female athletes. So again, that's the unfairness of it, coupled with what I alluded to in the locker room, which, like, it's impossible to put into words the feelings of violation when you're in an intimate area of undressing, such as a locker room, which is not, a swimming locker room is not a place of modesty, right? These suits that you're putting on, your racing suit, it's skin tight, it's paper thin, it takes like 15, 20 minutes to really poke and prod yourself into these suits. And that's 15 to 20 minutes of which you're fully exposed. Putting that suit on, having your back turned, and all of a sudden you hear a man's voice. It's like instinctual to like cover yourself with your towel or your hands or whatever, and you turn around and you literally have to look up because, again, he's so much taller than every woman in there. And there's a man taking off his women's swimsuit, fully naked, fully intact, fully exposing himself, inches away from where we were simultaneously fully undressed. It's awkward. It's embarrassing. It's uncomfortable. Really, it was feelings of just betrayal. Betrayal by people who were supposed to be protecting us. They had failed on every account. It was really these three things. Again, the obvious unfairness, the locker room, the infringement on our privacy as women. But I would say just as big of a contributing factor to why I felt confident and secure enough to take that initial leap of faith and to put my name and my face to this is the emotional blackmail that we faced as student athletes, as female athletes, to stay quiet during this time. My university sent me to sensitivity training, which didn't really work, but I had to go, where they sat me down. They brought in what they called an outside professional, never telling us what the qualifications of this woman, which was ironic. Well, it's a woman. All of the outside professionals that they brought in were women, which is really telling. She sat me down and she taught me how to use, as a 21-year-old senior in college, she taught me how to use the words she and her in a sentence. I had to keep going through this training until they felt like I had been properly re-educated. We had to participate in restorative justice circles where we learned about how we, as women, we were the oppressors in this story. He was the victim. He just wanted to be happy. We were impeding on his happiness. How could we live with ourselves? Some things matter more than winning. That's what they told us. You know, yes, you're playing college sports at the Division I level. Sure, it's elite, but it doesn't really matter when we're talking about another person's happiness. You have to sacrifice that for this person. We were told we would lose our scholarships, you'd lose your friend, you'll never get a job. No employer will ever hire you if you speak about this because, you know, they'll look you up. It's standard practice. They're going to see that you're a transphobe. You'll never get a job. Riley, you want to go to dental school? Sorry, no dental school will ever even look at your application if you speak about this. More outside professionals who came in, who sat us down as a team and told us that our rhetoric, it was harmful. It could physically hurt someone somewhere. We could cause someone to do that to themselves, self-inflicted for that matter, and we would be responsible. And that would make us responsible for potential death. And that would make us a murderer. And you don't want to be a murderer. You don't want to have blood on your hands. No, so just be kind. That's what they told us. Another woman who came in and sat my team down and said, look, girls, what you're advocating for, especially as it pertains to the locker room, sounds a lot like segregation. You know who else advocated for segregation? The KKK and white supremacists. And that's not the side of history that you want to be on, is it? No, so just be inclusive. That's what they told us. That's why there were so few. Not because they thought us as athletes who shared a pool deck and the pool and the locker room with him, not because we thought it was fair or righteous or just or moral by any means, but because they were terrified. And understandably so. I would imagine many of you, whether it was during COVID, whether it pertains to any of the other cultural issues, the chaos that's plaguing this country, I would imagine many of you have your own stories, whether it's in your place of work, those of you who are younger in high school or college. I mean, I'm sure you've been tasked to write an essay at some point, a persuasive essay on feminism, and you maybe wanted to write it on this topic, but you felt like you couldn't because you wanted to get a good grade, right? So you've dealt with it too. I don't probably have to explain even that to you. But all of those things are ultimately what really pushed me over the edge.
Riley Gaines during the Illinois Family Institute's 2025 Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet in Homer Glen. More of her remarks from that event right after this.
Need somewhere to belong? Try here. We're socialites. Find us at socialites.blog. We aim to cultivate meaningful friendships and create places for people to come together face to face.
We do weekly group, Bible study groups, swing dancing. We even do bonfires on occasion.
We also connect churches via their YA groups in the Chicagoland area.
We want to be the answer to the question of, where do you even meet people anymore? Come find us at socialites.blog. Check out some of the events we got going or any of the groups that we host regularly.
Socialites.blog.
Joining Illinois Family Spotlight for this edition, remarks from Riley Gaines at the Illinois Family Institute's 2025 Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet. In this segment, the conservative activist warns against complacency and silence in the fight to protect life and the ongoing struggle against gender ideology.
Let me tell you what I've learned these past three-ish years. First and foremost, it's that gender ideology is an evil lie from the pit of hell. It is a lie that is built on deception, on discouragement, and destruction. And who does that sound a lot like? Telling young kids, or adults for that matter, that they were created wrong, that they're correct to feel as if they were born in the wrong body, that God made a mistake with them. It is a lie that leads to children, or again adults, cutting off healthy body parts and injecting themselves with unnatural synthetic chemicals and substances in an attempt to, I guess, be satisfied with themselves, when in reality, it's satisfaction that they're after is fleeting. I know as a Christian that the only place that we will ever be satisfied is in a personal relationship with Christ. We've seen the deception and the discouragement. Number one, just the verbiage itself, right? How our language, the English language, has been manipulated entirely. Verbiage like gender-affirming care. It sounds so positive, right? You have that word affirmation in there. But what a horrible message to send, to tell people that they're correct to feel as if they're born wrong. No wonder that suicide rates are higher amongst this demographic. Of course, when you're telling them they're born wrong, what do you think is going to be the case? We should be telling them that they're perfect just the way God intentionally and uniquely created them in His perfect image. Words like compassion and empathy and inclusion itself. Just know when you hear someone specifically, I hate to make this partisan, it really shouldn't be a partisan issue, but when you hear people use words like inclusion from the Democratic Party, your brain should automatically replace that with exclusion. Because what we saw, what we faced as women, it wasn't inclusion, we were excluded. We were excluded from a category meant to include us. I've had the displeasure of testifying before Congress, the U.S. Senate, many times now, and I really mean the displeasure. Like, the first time I testified before Congress, I was really intimidated, right? Like, I'm like a 22-23-year-old girl. I didn't know, like, anything about our government at all. I knew we had three branches. I didn't really know what they did. I still don't really know what they do. I don't even think they know what they do, actually. I was testifying, sat before Congress, so intimidated. And it took me all of 5 minutes to realize that they're really not as smart as they make themselves out to be. You get them off of their piece of paper that their staffer prepared for them, and they really don't know the topic of the committee, what is being discussed. And it was actually Senator Durbin. Would you know it? You guys are like, yeah, we do know. It was Senator Durbin. We've heard this time and time and time again. But specifically in this moment, he says, you know, well, where is our compassion for our trans athletes? And I look at him and I say, Senator Durbin, where is your compassion for women? And of course, he didn't have anything to say back to that. Words like reproductive freedom, our healthcare freedom, our reproductive rights, right? That's just a fancy way to say prematurely ending human life. Words like clump of cells, or just describing a developing child as tissue or whatever they say. The word woman itself, how that has been manipulated. We've seen in legislative bodies where they've attempted to change the word woman to like menstruator or cervix haver or uterus owner or chest feeder or bleeder or, and I think Wisconsin, they referred to mothers as inseminated persons. Yeah. Which they deceptively did this in a budget bill is how they got through with this, which I know the legislators in the room know exactly how this works. So we've seen our language be entirely manipulated. And I will say, on the discussion of inseminated persons, of moms, the only thing more sinister than cutting off healthy body parts is prematurely ending life before those body parts ever even get a chance to fully develop. This is something that, as a new mom, our little daughter, she's just about a month old. But now, looking at the abortion epidemic, it's not just a matter of politics or policy. Like, it's deeply personal to me. I've always been pro-life because I've always been a Christian. And with that, having conservative values, I've known that, of course, we have a God who condemns the shedding of innocent blood, a God who breathes purpose and value into every life inside the womb or then translated to outside the womb. So I've always been pro-life, but I will never forget going to that first 8-week appointment and hearing her little heartbeat for the first time. Guess what? That heartbeat, just like yours does, just like mine does. Or going to the anatomy scan at 20 weeks, and you see these little bitty hands and little bitty feet, and we were told it's a girl, and she had the cutest little button nose. I'll never forget that. Or now, of course, her being here, it makes the thought, the practice of abortion, like hurt deeply and viscerally. I want to tell you guys why I feel hopeful. I mean, you hear all that and you're like, what? Hopeful, encouraged, how? I'll tell you why. Number one, we have seen a lot of legislative wins. I've talked about what President Trump has done, what we've seen at the national stage, at the federal level, but even amongst the states. 27 states have now passed some sort of fairness in women's sports bill, ultimately protecting women's sports. We've seen now, yeah, don't clap too soon, your state has not. But not for lack of trying. You have fantastic legislators in this room, representatives and senators who have done their part, who have filed legislation, but to no prevail, because the other side of the aisle won't even vote it out of committee. And even if they did, I think you know what your governor would do to this bill if it was on his desk. We've seen 17 states ultimately define the word woman in law, which is crazy we have to do. Again, the state of Illinois has filed this several times, but to no prevail. So it's merely a bill, like a definitional bill. It defines man, woman, male, female, girl, boy, mother, father. Crazy we have to do that. Although shouldn't really be too surprised, we have a sitting Supreme Court justice who can't even answer what a woman is because she claims she's not a biologist. Which, guess what? I'm not a veterinarian, but I know what a dog is. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. We have seen teams across the nation, even here in this state, ultimately deciding to boycott, I put an extra emphasis on that word, boy, when they get up to the net or on the court or at the starting line and they realize that their opponent has a male on their team, or the man next to him or next to her at that state championship is not actually like the rest of the girls. It's a boy. And so we've seen girls stepping down saying, look, truth matters. Our safety as women, especially in sports where there's collision or throwing something at one another, we're not willing to risk our safety for this. We're not participating in the farce. That leaves me feeling encouraged. We've seen corporations backing down. We have seen hospitals ending the horrific practice of unregulated child butchery. We have seen lawsuits that are being filed successfully, winning, being victorious. There's a lawsuit right now titled Gaines versus NCAA. Super fun to sue someone with such deep pockets, by the way. But despite all of the wins, I guess a forceful message I want to send to you all is that the war on woke, if that's what you want to call it, it has not been won, which living here, I wouldn't imagine I have to tell you all that. I'm sure you see that on a daily basis, especially when you have a governor who hates Trump more than he loves you. That's what it boils down to. He hates Trump more than he cares about the people who live in his state. We've seen where the idea of complacency, I believe it's a plague. We just saw with what seems like a blue sweep in states like New Jersey, Virginia, obviously I alluded to Mom Donnie in New York City. The Democrats, they don't become complacent. I think our side, I hate to make it sides, I really do. I think those of us with common sense, maybe that's a better way to put it, I do believe there's a level of complacency. And it's natural, right? Like when you are successful, that's what it breeds. It breeds complacency. But what does complacency breed? It breeds failure. It is the enemy to growth. It's the enemy to progress. The Democrats don't do that. They keep pushing forward. They don't allow themselves to be steamrolled. Again, in reality, they haven't been defeated. As we see on social media all the time, political pundits saying, well, wokeness is dead, we're so back. No, in reality, you know what the left has done? They just put their most extreme and radical guy in charge of one of the most important cities in the country. They're not ruined. They're not defeated. Again, Mamdani, like his platform is like free buses and free healthcare for illegal immigrants and city-run grocery stores, defunding the police while simultaneously opening up the prisons, releasing violent criminals into the streets, preventing law-abiding citizens from accessing and owning guns. And every single so-called mainstream Democrat, they're lining up behind him, right? He is now the leader. He's the face of the Democratic Party. And again, that should terrify you. You know what we heard in his victory speech? The quote was, he said, "We will prove that there is no problem too large for government to solve and no concern too small for it to care about." If you're a freedom-loving American, those are the most terrifying words you could possibly hear. It's in total contrast to what Ronald Reagan said, which is the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." That's that on steroids, okay? They lost precisely one election in 2024, but they have not moderated. They have not backed down. They have not recant from their positions or their voting records. No, they're leaning into their radicalism even more so. Again, in Virginia, they just elected an attorney general who is guilty of the most extreme violent rhetoric that I believe we've heard from a major party candidate at any level in any race. This is a guy who said in documented text exchange that he wants to watch the children of his political opponents die in their parents' arms. And he won. That is a condemnation of humanity. Okay, that's what that is. So no, Charlie's death, more proof that woke is not dead. Right, this was a man who, I mean, his whole mantra was, prove me wrong. That's all he was there to do, specifically to Gen Z, encouraging thought and debate and civil discourse on college campuses, the place where these ideas are supposed to foster and grow. And they couldn't prove him wrong. So what did the coward do? The coward shot him and killed him. That is proof that wokeness is not dead. And these issues that we're talking about, whether it is gender ideology, whether it's crime, whether it's the border, whether it's parental rights, whatever it is, the stance that I have taken, I mean, it was the default position of both parties not that long ago. Don't believe me? Go watch even Obama or Bill Clinton speak to some of the things of the border and illegal immigration. How many people they deported out of this country. It's far more than President Trump, but you wouldn't know that. The position that I have on most issues is the default, the standard position. When I first started using my voice, right, I didn't want to be seen as disrespectful or mean or controversial because I knew I wasn't those things. I knew I wasn't this made-up word of transphobic or whatever other derogatory term they'll call you, and they will call you at all, anything under the sun. They'll call you racist for saying men shouldn't be in women's sports. They'll call you a misogynist, weirdly enough. I get that one all the time. I'm like, I'm the misogynist for wanting to protect women's opportunities and safety and privacy. I was just a college student, just an athlete who wanted fairness, who was in dental school, set to specialize in endodontics. By no means did, I guess, where I ever saw myself. Never the direction I pictured my life would go. But of course, I was reminded that truth will always be controversial in a world that is built on lies. And I believe if we, as believers, as Christians, if we don't speak up, if we don't use our voice, if we don't stand firm and unapologetically for what is both objectively true and biblically true, like it goes back to the first book, like he created them male and female. If we don't stand for the most basic of truths, then who in the world will? This world is loud about everything except the truth, but I don't believe we have the luxury of silence anymore. I think of verses. Actually, someone approached me today, and she said, look, you're like Esther. And that means so much to me when I hear that. When you hear that, you think of Esther 4:14, for such a time as this, the last half of that verse. But I want to remind you of the front half of that verse, because it applies to every single one of us. It says, for if you remain silent, it's talking to you and me, for if you remain silent, you and your father's family will perish. We were not saved as Christians to be silent. We were saved to serve. I appreciate you guys. I truthfully believe that there is no better use of your time, of any amount of volunteering, of your finances, than supporting grassroots efforts like IFI. Again, this is an institute that lobbies for bills that you care about, bills that are rooted in traditional values. They testify on these bills. They produce resources and voter guides. They fund candidates. They help find those candidates. They support them. They lift them up. That is exactly what this state needs. And so I believe when, by supporting IFI, what you're doing is you're investing in the future of your kids, the future of your grandkids, and there's no better investment than that right there. So I would encourage you to look at it not as if you're giving to IFI, but you're giving through IFI. No better investment. I really mean that. Thank you guys very, very much.
Riley Gaines during the Illinois Family Institute's 2025 Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet. You can view her speech on the IFI YouTube channel. Please support the ministry of IFI. All donations are tax deductible. To give, click donate on the IllinoisFamily.org homepage or call 708-781-9328. Your support is very much appreciated. Be sure to sign on for IFI email updates at illinoisfamily.org. Make plans to join cultural researcher and author Dr. George Barna at IFI's 2026 Worldview Conference, Saturday, March 7th at Belmont Bible Church in Downers Grove. Tell your family and friends about Illinois Family Spotlight. Until next time, stay healthy, stay active, and God bless.
For more information about Illinois Family Spotlight, visit ifiaction.org. And to email questions and comments, do so at feedback@ifiaction.org.